The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Keep sending those emails to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for your support, your encouragement, and your comments, too. Some very insightful comments that we receive from time to time, not only in response to this program, but the growing number of programs that we have now on KPCG. Well, on Monday, President Obama gave a speech in Washington. This was, I guess it's called the Toner Prize for Excellence in Political Reporting. So he had quite a few things to say about the news and about reporting and about how reporters cover the news. And I thought before I got to some excerpts from that speech that I just would read to you what Christ said over in Matthew 7. Matthew 7, in the first few verses, where he says, he's talking about at the start of the chapter, judge not lest you be judged. But then in verse 3, he says, why behold you the mote that is in your brother's eye, but consider not the beam that is in your own eye? Or how will you say to your brother, let me pull out the mote out of your own eye, and behold, the beam is in your own eye? And then verse 5, you hypocrite. First, God says, this is what Christ admonished us. First, cast out the beam out of your own eye, and then you shall see clearly to cast out the mote out of your brother's eye. Get rid of the beam first, and then you can go and, well, actually help your brother. There's a companion verse to this over in Galatians 6, where it says, when a brother's overtaken in a fault, that you can go to that one, that brother, in a spirit of meekness. But Paul said there, consider yourself first, lest you also be tempted. In other words, look at yourself first. Don't go in as a hypocrite. Make sure that you get rid of the beam first, and then you can help your brother. You can help your brother. Now, some of the comments that President Obama said about the press in this speech on Monday, some of it is it's pretty good, talking about shallowness in the media. I mean, who can argue with that? Let me just play the first clip. As I said, this is from a speech on Monday at the 2016 Toner Prize Ceremony in Washington, D.C.
So I believe the electorate would be better served if your networks and your producers would give you the room, the capacity to follow your best instincts and dig deeper into the things that might not always be flashy but need attention.
And so he encourages reporters to go deeper. He said later in the speech that when historians 10, 20 years from now are looking back to try to understand this period we're living through now, that they're not going to be searching through tweets and seeing who got the most retweets. He said they'll be looking for the kind of reporting, the smartest investigative journalism that told our story and lifted up the contradictions in our societies and asked the hard questions and forced people to see the truth, even when it was uncomfortable. And so there's quite a lot of criticism aimed at the media today. Some would say he's throwing the media that helped get him into office, that he's throwing them under the bus. But if you look at the way his own administration has operated these past 7 years, and just the amount of time and energy they've put into tweets and retweets and pictures and photos and hashtags and selfie sticks, and even with the kinds of organizations that he's interviewed with. And when you look at the way he's gone after organizations like Fox News, James Rosen comes to mind, where he went after the phone records of the Fox News reporter and even his parents. This has just happened in the last few years. Going back to his re-election campaign, there were reports of him or his administration dictating the interview topics that would be discussed. If he were to grant an interview with a local TV reporter, quite a lot about trying to edit what the press pool reports would cover. One reporter, Jake Tapper, admitted that he thought, and he's not a hardcore conservative by any means, but he thought the media helped tip the scales in President Obama's favor back in 2012. So that's just been some of the track record or the history from this current administration. And now he's coming to the end and he is rising above the fray and saying how much the reporters need to dig deeper, how much more depth we need in the coverage. Notice this next clip from the speech he gave on Monday.
A job well done is about more than just handing someone a microphone. But it's to probe and to question and to dig deeper and to demand more. The electorate would be better served if that happened. It would be better served if billions of dollars in free media came with serious accountability. Especially when politicians issue unworkable plans or make promises they can't keep.
And so that last statement there, there's been quite a few people commenting on the free coverage or the billions of dollars. Some have said $2 billion worth of free media coverage that Donald Trump has benefited from. And now, of course, in the position that President Obama is in, he can look at that and say, wow, what in the world? And then he's out there with all these unworkable plans, making promises that he cannot keep. And you in the media, you should see this and you should ask the deep questions. You should dig deep. You should confront. It's so easy, isn't it, to see the flaws, the sins, the problems in someone else. It's so easy to see that, and it's very difficult. As Christ pointed out there in Matthew 7, it's very difficult to see the beam that's in our own eyes. Notice what he went on to say here, and again, I think you can get a pretty good idea of who he's aiming these comments at.
When people put their faith in someone who can't possibly deliver on his or her promises, that only breeds more cynicism.
So politicians are out there, they're not delivering on their promises, and it's just breeding more cynicism in the political environment, and that's why this election cycle is the way it is. I mean, in his mind, this current election cycle is very different than the past two. Because in this one, you have politicians who are making all sorts of promises that they won't be able to deliver on. But what about the promises this individual has made? What about the promises he made in 2012 or even the ones that were more grandiose and far-fetched and otherworldly, in fact, back in 2008? And so many people were just embracing it. Sure, that this was some kind of superhero, that this was some kind of messiah. Notice what then-Senator Obama said back when he accepted the Democratic nomination in June of 2008.
Generations from now, we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when we began to provide care for the sick and good jobs to the jobless. This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal. This was the moment when we ended a war and secured our nation and restored our image as the last best hope on earth.
Quite a few promises there. that weren't kept. Well, actually, I'll play a quote from you from that Monday speech a little bit later where he's convinced that he followed through. He's done it right. He's quite unlike the ones of 2016. He's followed through on his promises. But of course, if you go back to speeches like that from June of 2008, you see how misguided it is, how hopeless it is to put our trust in men, as the prophet Jeremiah said. In fact, he said, "Cursed be the man that trusts in man." Look at how many people are willing to put all of their faith in a human being or in a political party. You might remember what we wrote the night that President Obama was elected. This is back in 2000, or rather November of 2008, sorry. I think it was Joel Hilliker. He said, many people are looking to the new president-elect as a kind of Messiah. Their credulity shows just how great the need for a true Messiah is. People do recognize many of the pressing problems and the crushing concerns of our age. They can see that the present government doesn't have the answers. But what they do not yet see, as has become plain in this election, is that by seeking those answers simply in another political candidate, they are misplacing their hope. See, it's history repeating itself, isn't it? Only it's just a little bit worse, perhaps. Although if you go back to 2008 and look at the level of dishonest coverage in the media, I think you could argue that it was worse in 2008. I mean, some of the shenanigans going back and forth between the politicians running in this cycle, that's certainly unique, at least in my lifetime. But when you look at what the mainstream media did for the Obama administration to bring him to power, well, that's a story that you can't just gloss over, or you certainly can't revise that history. Some have tried. In fact, President Obama tried on Monday in that speech. But you can go back and look at what the trumpet was saying. And you can go back yourself and look at what the news media was reporting on and not reporting on. In any event, coming back to this article, this nation has not yet to realize that there's no hope in man. That's what we wrote, again, the night that President Obama was elected. And then notice this statement. We've read this many times. Soon it will be this new government trying desperately to keep the economy from tanking, grappling with international security concerns that exceed the military's capabilities, being mistreated by foreign governments, sinking deeper into debt, and so on. It will be this government letting the people down. That's why you have the reaction that you have this election cycle, because so many people see that this current government has let the people down, and so they're looking for another man to place their faith in. Another kind of Messiah, another Superman. It shows the dearth in leadership, true Christian leadership. Today, Isaiah 3 prophesies of this. I mean, you think of the current administration coming on board 7 years ago with the firm belief that, well, the solution to everything is just bigger government. Take over this company, take over the automotive industry, take over the mortgage insurance, you name it. Federalize the healthcare industry. Take over as many sectors of the economy as you can. And yet look at the state of the United States today, the State of the Union. Look at the levels of debt. Look at the disastrous universal health care coverage. There's so many articles out there about it. Well, you can have your pick. But as I say, in the eyes of this administration, in the eyes of this president, he's followed through. He's delivered. And I guess in some ways you could say, well, he certainly has transformed the nation. And he did come in promising that. So perhaps he's getting at that with this next statement that I'll play for you. This is from his speech on Monday.
But something I'm really proud of is the fact that if you go back and see what I said in 2007 and you see what I did, they match up. Now, part of the reason they match up is because in 2008, during the campaign, people asked me really tough questions about whether they'd match up. And we had to spend a lot of time worrying about whether what I said I could deliver on and whether we believed it was true. And there was a price if you said one thing and then did something completely different. And the question is, in the current media environment, is that still true? Does that still hold?
That's really an amazing statement. It matched up, he said, because, well, the media was faithful. The media held him accountable. He had, as you remember, or was supposed to have, a very transparent administration. He knew there'd be a price to pay if he told a lie or if he made a promise that he wouldn't be able to deliver. I mean, that's just astonishing. That's historical revisionism. Because anyone with just an ounce of objectivity knows that he's had most in the major media covering for him all the way, every step of the way. And this has even been acknowledged in some quarters as prominent journalists, in looking back on 2008, have said, you know what? We never really did hold him accountable. We never really did vet him. That's what Tom Brokaw admitted. We never really looked into his past. We gave him a free pass on that. Only a very few voices were sounding the alarm on what should have been very alarming associations. What should have been a very disturbing background, a very disturbing ideology for a president wanting to fundamentally transform the United States of America. But coming back to this point about the media, again, he says he was able to follow through on what he promised, partly because the media was there to keep him in check. Partly because the media was doing its job to dig deep. Let me just play for you an exchange. This is in 2008. It's when Charlie Rose interviewed Tom Brokaw about the coverage of President Obama coming up to his first election.
There's so many things that I don't know, you know, in terms of the makeup of the people. We've gone through this long campaign. I care about it almost as much as you do in terms of being a political junkie. But there are questions you don't know in terms of, I don't know what Barack Obama's worldview is. I really don't know.
No,
I don't know how he really sees where China is and where it wants to go and how smart he is about that, or India, or the whole global structure.
Mark Salter, who is, as we said earlier, very close to John McCain, says one of his big frustrations is that at the back of their bus, their plane, there are young bloggers who have really never had much experience in life. And if they summon them to the front of the plane to have a kind of in-depth discussion about where Senator McCain may be or what he's thinking, he said they're only waiting for the gotcha moment. And then they rush back to get it on the blog. You don't get the long curve discussion anymore on these planes or in these campaigns.
Okay, speak to that. I mean, a media assessment of this campaign.
You've got a role in this. And you've got to be more vigilant, more energetic, and you've got to work harder at where you get your information. And then developing that litmus test about its worthiness. You know, does it hold up? Am I being rolled here by someone? you know, it's not just a benign process, this business of getting information. You've got to bring intellectual vigor to it.
So he said, well, there's a lot to unpack there. I don't know his worldview, Charlie Rose said. Tom Brokaw said, I don't either. And then he goes on to explain how that in that election cycle, that's 2008, that you just didn't get the long, in-depth pieces. And then the part where he said, you've got a role in this, that's Tom Brokaw looking at the camera, telling the general public, you know, you have a role to play in this. You've got to, as a general populace, you've got to seek depth in the coverage. You've got to hold the media responsible. Now, that's someone who, as Charlie Rose noted there, he was immersed right in the middle of it all in 2008. And that's coming from someone in the mainstream, someone well-known, a prominent voice who acknowledged, you know, we didn't really vet him. We didn't really know him. We didn't really know his worldview. You see, they got caught up in that Messiah complex. They got caught up in what we were talking about the night he was elected. The media did. They too were looking for this new kind of Messiah. And they got what they wanted. And is America better off for it? Well, you can try to gloss over the problems if you want. But whether you look at the crushing levels of debt spending, whether you look at the political cycle today or all the things that are being pointed out by some of the opponents now, how that we're losing on trade, how that we're losing with this, how that we have open borders, how that we have this. I mean, the problems are just mounting. And so here comes the general populace again, searching for a savior, searching for a political party or a leader, a candidate, a new guy that they can place their hope in. And God is saying through it all, there's no hope in man. It's interesting, just in running a search on thetrumpet.com. This goes back to 2002, so this is early on in President Bush's presidency. My father, writing about the media bias and where it's leading us, I think I've quoted from this before. It's a pretty good take. He says here, the press is either shallow or they fear to speak the truth. Either way, this is an extreme danger. See, we were talking about the shallowness, the lack of courage back in 2012. How could anyone, as I say, with an ounce of objectivity, say that, well, today in 2016, it's shallow and it's all about the tweets and this and that. But in 2008, well, then it was just 8 years ago or 7 years ago, then it was really in depth. Then it was, I mean, top-notch coverage. It was shallow in 2008. It was shallow in 2002. And that's an extreme danger, like my father notes. What's the problem doing to our people? They see the media are not really seeking the truth as they profess to be. This causes the people to rely more and more on themselves. That's what it causes. And then he quotes Judges 21:25, where it says, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. My father said they didn't trust anybody but themselves. They made the same mistakes we are making today, and the nation fell. This has just been the trajectory that we've been on, that Herbert Armstrong talked about in the United States and Britain in prophecy. Now, obviously, you can look at things today and point out that it is worsening. There are a lot of things about 2016 that are much worse than 2008, and a lot of things about 2008 that are much worse than 2002. But we just keep making the same mistakes, only worse, bigger, each time around. And always, 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 you can expect that as bad as it gets, there is still going to be this blind faith in some man, some political party, some new movement, some new politician that we think, that we hope this time around will finally, finally be able to fix everything that's wrong. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Robert Morley has a piece featured at thetrumpet.com today with an eye-catching title, Free Money for Everyone! Exclamation point. It's about what's happening in Canada. Mr. Morley says, what if the government paid you just to exist? You could just sit on your couch year-round and paychecks would just magically arrive, $20,000 per year. Sounds like another fraudulent make money from home, sham cluttering your email box. But Ontario's hoping to enshrine it into law. This is what the government in Ontario, Canada wants. During its last budget, it says the Canadian province of Ontario announced that it will begin testing a guaranteed basic income scheme. It plans to send every citizen in a yet unannounced city a government check. Premier Kathleen Wynne said her government would test a growing view at home and abroad that a basic income could build on the success of minimum wage policies and increases in child benefits by providing more consistent and predictable support in the context of today's dynamic labor market. It sounds so good, doesn't it? I mean, if it catches on here, as Mr. Morley says, it may be that Prime Minister Trudeau extends it to the entire nation. Robert writes, supporters say that in an age of increasing technology where jobs are being replaced by machines and many people are unable to compete, the government must redistribute the wealth. They say basic income schemes will reduce welfare budgets by simplifying and eliminating bureaucracy. All other welfare programs, food stamps, housing aid, utility supplements, etc., will be replaced by a single lump sum check to each citizen to spend as they please. So this is what it's come to, all of these social or welfare programs. And now they're just going to reduce it to a very simple, well, here's your check each month. Here's a couple $1,000. Spend it like you want. And don't worry about getting a job. Mr. Morley says, who's going to pay for it? Advocates say high-income earners and corporations should pay a little more to the government. Well, of course, the rich or the wealthier, they should pay in more so that the poorer people have more, so that there's more handouts to go around. He says here, forget that higher taxes mean slower economic growth, which means fewer jobs, which means higher unemployment. After all, who needs to work when you can get a government check? I mean, where will it end? To pay for these programs, of course, you have to raise taxes, and that hurts the economy. That means less jobs to go around. And then it only makes matters worse when you have people sitting at home without a job, getting checks in the mail, free money for everyone. How many people would keep working if they could instead go fishing or watch movies all day? Mr. Morley asks. But don't worry, say advocates. There's no proof that free money leads to laziness. That's what the proponents of this program say. Well, there's no studies. You can't show me that this actually fuels laziness. You can't show me that this hurts people. And, of course, there's all kinds of studies to show. I mean, just look at the increase in the number of people who, in the case of the United States, are on food stamps, for example. There's too many studies to even cover. But there's advocates out there convinced that this is the way to go, that this will make life better for so many people. And meanwhile, you see the poverty rate on the increase in the United States. You see more and more people on the dole in the United States, in Canada, in the UK. The numbers for the food stamps program is just one example. We've reported before how that studies in recent years have shown that half of all Americans live inside of a home where someone there is receiving government benefits. Half. I mean, there's half now, less than half, that are even paying into the system. And so what happens when that percentage continues to dwindle, when more and more people are on the dole? What happens when you only have 20, 30% paying into the system? Well, it's like the late Prime Minister Thatcher said about how great socialism is until you run out of other people's money. Eventually it runs out. And you'd think these smart politicians would understand as much. If you look into the Bible, and they don't want to do that. Of course, that's the last place that an economist or a politician would look. But really, I mean, if you did a personal study on work or employment or your work habits or your approach to work, you will find hundreds of references. And they're not just in the book of Proverbs. There's plenty of them in there for sure. But there's close to 1,000 references in the Bible that have to do with employment and work habits. This is an important subject in God's mind, work ethic. In the Bible, it says, if you don't work, you don't eat. Try telling that to the leaders in Ontario. Try telling that to the Prime Minister of Canada. We referred to Herbert Armstrong's example over the years. You read through his autobiography, and it's a real eye-opener. And, of course, he was inspired by others like Benjamin Franklin, whose autobiography really motivated him, Mr. Armstrong. But if you look at Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, he talked about how he learned to work as a young man. at the age of 16, where he was starting out waiting on tables like so many used to do. And as a 16-year-old, I mean, this is back in the early 1900s, he really poured his heart into that opportunity. And his boss took note and complimented him on his work ethic. This is from his autobiography. He said, soon he began to tell me that he could see qualities in me that were destined to carry me to large success in life. He constantly expressed great confidence in me and what I would be able to accomplish if I was willing to put forth the effort. Now, if you're getting $20,000 a year sitting at home in Canada, is that really preparing you for a life of productivity and prosperity? I mean, $20,000 is really not that much in this day and age, but it's enough. It's enough if you're willing to live in a lousy apartment to sit around and watch movies and do not much of anything. As it is, I mean, Mr. Armstrong learned as a teenager that if he was going to make something of his life, he had to get out there and really put forth the effort. He had to really apply himself in school, on the job. He couldn't just follow along with the crowd. He had to do something. He said that hotel manager that complimented him, he really aroused in Mr. Armstrong this ambitious desire to make something of his life. There's so many benefits to come from employment, even for teenagers who are just out there in their first job as a hotel, a wait staff, in a restaurant, wherever. In the autobiography, it says, it's impossible to estimate the importance of this sudden arousal of ambition, this injection of an intense desire for success, this igniting of the spark of determined energy to achieve worthy accomplishment. He says, this was the turning point of my life. This was the turning point in his life, and it revolved around work. It started with him as a 16-year-old working as a busboy in a hotel restaurant. It was a turning point. I mean, suddenly life became, as he said, a whole new ballgame. This spirit, this ambitious spirit was awakened. And then let me just read to you what, well, first maybe we could just take a quick break and I can get something to drink. And we'll come back and finish up this study with some really helpful and encouraging scriptures. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
All right, let's see if we can finish this. My voice is betraying me here. But coming back to this point about this spark of ambition that Mr. Armstrong had there at 16 working in that hotel, he said in his autobiography that this is the vital ingredient that's been missing in most human lives. Most continue through life as I was prior to this arousal of ambition. He said the idea of looking forward to achieving success or an accomplishment or any note, never intruded itself into my mind. nor does it probably to the average mind. It says, and it was like an intrusion, for my mind was uninterruptedly occupied only with the interests, pleasures, and enjoyments of the moment. Now that's him writing at age 16 in the early 1900s. We've talked a lot in recent weeks about the many distractions that are out there, about the sin of escapism, about the need to manage our time, about the need to make the most of our moments. If it was that way in 1908, whatever it would have been, think about it today, with so many in our nations now addicted to the social programs, the government handouts. But here's a case, Herbert Armstrong, here's a case where you look back at his autobiography, you see what happened at age 16, and I mean, that was the beginning of really what turned out to be an illustrious working career that would continue without interruption for nearly 8 decades. Now, as he points out in his autobiography, of course, prior to his conversion to the truth, he was out there basically motivated and ambitious to be a material success, a success in business. But then when God crushed his vanity, that ambitious desire, that drive for success, it was redirected. And in fact, it intensified as he started to serve his great God, his Creator. And then he was finally pursuing goals that really mattered. That's when Mr. Armstrong started working with God. That's when he went into a partnership with God. And God, as I think we understand and know, is himself a great worker. Jesus said in John 9, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day, for the night comes when no man can work. Jesus Christ was a hard worker. He said about his Father, my Father works and I work. I mean, he followed in the example of his Father. And in that verse I just read, he said, I need to work while there's still time. I mean, he worked with a sense of urgency. And that's the way that we must work, to just tie in some of those comments or those messages I've given of late about the urgency of the time that we're in and managing our time in this last hour and really getting out there and working for God. That should be a strong motivation. But of course, the strongest motivation comes right out from the law of God. This is in Exodus 20. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8, it says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So here is that Sabbath command, the fourth commandment. And within that command, it says in verse 9, 6 days shall you labor and do all your work. 6 days you shall labor. In those 6 days you shall work. You should do all your work. That means we were made to work. God created us to be workmen, just like Jesus Christ was. And that's why this is such an insidious evil, what we see happening in our nations today. That's not to say that God doesn't have a welfare program for those that are in need of help. But it's certainly not meant to be a regular handout that goes on indefinitely, that discourages people from working. A godly handout is meant to get someone back on their feet so that they can get back to work. Because as it says in Exodus 20, 6 days shall you labor and do all your work. And by doing this, we're following in some pretty good footsteps. In verse 11, it says, for in 6 days the Eternal made heaven and earth and sea, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day, wherefore the Lord blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. So here God gives us this command and says, this is the way I've operated. This is what I do. If you go back to Genesis 2 and you look at the environment that God put Adam and Eve in, he told them in verse 15 there to dress and to keep the garden. And you can study on your own the meaning of those words in Hebrew. It really has to do with being a slave or having a slave-like mentality. Really getting out there and working the land. Working in the garden. Now, as I say, you can look throughout the Bible, study later on your own time in Exodus 16, where God proved the Israelites when he rained manna down from heaven, and see in that chapter just how rigorous the work was for them to gather each day and a double portion on the sixth day to get ready for the Sabbath. As I say, you can look throughout the Bible and see hundreds and hundreds of examples, hundreds and hundreds of verses talking about work, work ethic, talking about how that we ought not to be lazy, and that if we're lazy, we don't deserve to eat. This is from an old World Tomorrow program. I should have tried to get the audio clip from this. But it says here, this is Mr. Armstrong in 1979, the idea of happiness that has been generated in this world is laziness, sitting around in idleness and ease, and playing on a harp, perhaps, and having nothing to do but being waited on. He says, we're degenerating so fast that you just can't see it, and nobody will believe it because we like to kid ourselves and to be deceived into thinking we're getting better and better. And you talk to the Canadian officials in Ontario, and I'm sure they'd say, you know, let's consolidate all these welfare programs and just start sending people a check for $1,500 a month or whatever it is. And it sounds good. It sounds like everything's getting better and better. But Mr. Armstrong says here, you only get better and better when you work at it. That's the thing. And really, if we're honest, we still see that same lesson in so many different areas of life. You only get better and better when you work at it. But he went on to say in that message, we don't like to work. And so we're not getting better and better. We're getting worse. He said it's like we're allergic to work. That's Herbert Armstrong's assessment from 1979. That's from 30-some years ago. God made us to work, and all through the Bible, he comes out in the strongest terms against laziness. It says in 1 Timothy 5, if any provide not for his own, and especially those for his own house, he's denied the faith, and he's worse than an infidel. He's not even really a true Christian. He's a non-believer if he's not out there working and providing for his own. Hard work is the surest evidence that you're a true Christian. These are principles discussed, as I say, in the Bible from cover to cover. 2 Thessalonians 3. This is the one I mentioned earlier, verse 10. For even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. Does that sound cruel? Does that sound harsh? That just comes out of the Word of God. That's God inspiring his apostle, the Apostle Paul. You tell the brethren that if they don't work, if they're not willing to get out there and work and work and work to get better, to better themselves, then they shouldn't eat. I mean, and look at the way these verses are worded. These are not suggestions. These are commands. And then you add to that all the many proverbs The soul of the sluggard desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made fat. He's out there diligently working, and he's reaping a lot because of it. If you continue reading that passage in 2 Thessalonians 3, I mean, if he's not going to work, he shouldn't eat. And then Paul in the very next verses says that we ought to avoid those who are walking disorderly or causing division. Verse 11 says, "For we hear that there are some which walk among you disorderly, working not at all, but they're busybodies. Now them that are such we command and exhort by our Lord Jesus Christ that with quietness they work and eat their own bread." Old Testament, New Testament, early on in Genesis, right through to 2 Thessalonians, all throughout. It says later, "But you, brethren, be not weary in well-doing." Don't grow weary. Keep working hard. Let me just conclude with a quote from the Correspondence Course. This is the old version produced by the Worldwide Church of God. It's lesson 55, some helpful and encouraging words of admonition for those who've perhaps let down or who are searching for work, who want to be productive, who want to get better and better. It says here, if you happen to be unemployed, you can start profiting from this principle right now. How? By making a job out of getting a job. Don't be a lazy job hunter. Get up early in the morning, consistently, and start out either arranging interviews or pounding the pavement early every morning, and don't quit until you've put in a full day's work looking for work. Either plan to eat in a restaurant on the way or take a sack lunch along with you so you can keep at it throughout the entire 8 or 9 hour workday. Don't waste time. This fits right in with what we've been discussing in recent weeks. Don't sit and brood at home and feel sorry for yourself. Get out and hustle and think. Remember that if you're seeking a higher type of employment, you may need to make telephone calls for this purpose. You can make 15 or 20 telephone calls for every personal visit to different business establishments. Keep at it. Don't give up. I mean, this is an older quote. You can just update it, modernize it somewhat, but the same principles apply. Keep at it and don't give up. It says, finally, when you approach a prospective member, be sure to put your best foot forward. Realize that this man should be a friend of yours and that you may share many happy hours in association with him and others in his organization in the future. So have a genuine smile on your face. Dress appropriately for the particular type of employment you're seeking, and dress neatly. Don't look dowdy, run down, or indifferent. Show real zeal in wanting to get the job. Let him know that you're ready to work hard. Let him know this by what you say, by how you look. That's some helpful admonition there, coming from that old Correspondence Course, the Ambassador College Correspondence Course, Lesson 5, from back in the 1960s. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream, as you know, is available at the trumpet.com website and also at kpcg.fm. Keep sending those emails. We appreciate all your comments. Send them to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us again today, and we'll see you tomorrow.